what do people who have trauma histories do? They keep active without any deep relationships. And if you talk to people who have had adversity, it's not that they don't want relationships, they don't want deep relationships. They will tell you their body doesn't allow them to have them. That if they get close, they're going to bolt out that room. So the paradox to those who have trauma histories is accessibility is translated in their nervous system as vulnerability. That they're telling you what it is that's most important in life. Most important in life is to be accessible, that enables you to connect. If you have a trauma history, you still have that intention.
Yeah,
but desire. Those lower brainstem areas say, not in this body, and will do whatever it can to, in a sense, navigate and negotiate to get the body out of the opportunity, or give the body permission to be safe in the arms of another.
But first, these messages. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Porges. This is such an honor. You are a literal forefather in this space of relating, but in the area of the nervous system. You invented polyvagal theory. Like, this feels like... Anyways, pinch me. I'm excited. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Mark. Yes, I did invent it. I made the word up. I didn't make the theory up, but I made the word up.
That's amazing. Well, maybe for people listening, we could give them a little idea of what is polyvagal theory.
Okay. We'll actually just cut to the real under point or major point, and that is our physiological state, the way our body feels, influences how we interact with the world. So when our bodies calm, we're much more accessible, accepting, flexible, compassionate, all the good stuff. And when our body shifts into a state of defense, we're reactive, defensive, critical, and often we're upset with ourselves. So the part is, if we have this system that is literally wired into us to be accessible and safe, why don't we use it?
Right. Yeah. And for you in your work, what led you to even go deeper down this path of wanting to understand the nervous system?
I'm not sure you want to ask that question, because the issue is, it's not the direct route that your interests are in. It's not a direct route of understanding relationships or connection. It was a route of trying to understand the neurophysiology of basically our autonomic nervous system, which is like regulating our heart. And I was studying newborn babies. And you could look at their heart rate patterns, and some babies would thrive and do well, and some were really at risk. And there was a pattern of heart rate that was very interesting to see. And that is, in a sense, with preterm babies that come in, their nervous system not very mature, their faces don't work, the vocalizations are more of a scream or high pitch. Well, their heart rate patterns were different than full-term babies.
Huh.
And I start to try to figure this out. The real point was that, in general, heart rate, when we have more of what's called vagal influence, this is the major nerve of the parasympathetic nervous system. We think of it as this calming, health-providing neural circuit, but it's much more confusing or complicated. So people talk about the vagus. We need more vagal tone. We need to stimulate the vagus. We need vagal exercises. But when I was working in the intensive care unit, I saw this paradox, and that was, when you had, in a sense, good vagal control of the heart had nice rhythms in it, representing good neural feedback. But if it got a surge of vagal tone, it could actually stop your heart. It would slow it up. So the full-term babies had these rhythmic patterns. The high-risk preterm babies had flat heart rate. And when the vagus came on, whoosh, they could potentially die. They weren't getting enough oxygenated blood. And so I was left with this paradox. How could the vagus both represent health, growth, restoration, and be protective, and also kill you? And the answer was, basically, people said, well, too much of a good thing is bad. Yeah, it didn't make any sense. So I really went into the neuroanatomy, the neurophysiology, and then comparative anatomy, which means you look at representations of evolutionary stages in present day vertebrates at different points. And what I found out was that literally there was a developmental pattern of how that vagus evolved or developed, and it paralleled evolution. And what you really had was not just one vagal pathway, you had two. So you had a vagal pathway that was unique to mammals, in which they actually have to get another kind of way of conceptualizing. The vagus is a nerve that connects the brain with virtually every organ in the body, your visceral organs. But that comes out of the brain in an area of what's called the brainstem, which is not a very big area. And we can literally describe it as being in the back or the front of the brainstem, dorsal or ventral. So the original vagus in the old primitive vertebrate comes from the dorsal, the back of the brain. And we kind of share this with virtually every vertebrate species, meaning jawless fish, spinal fish, you know, reptiles, amphibia, they have a vagus. It's part of what it is to kind of live and regulate your organs. Mm-hmm. But something happens, and now we're entering your world. Something happens at the transition from being a reptile, which is a, can be solitary, it's not a social organism or social species, to a mammal, which can only live through sociality. Or mm-hmm. co-regulation, or maternal infant behavior, all these connective behaviors. What happens is that the vagus, the area of the brainstem that controls the heart, meaning slows that heart rate up, some of the neurons in that area go for a journey. They migrate ventrally. And where do they end up? They end up at the area that regulates the nerves of your face. So in a sense, muscles, the face and head. So now the neurons that control your heart are interacting with the neurons that control your voice. Mm. So now this unique species or collection of species called mammals, not only do they suckle and nurse, which also required a ventral vagus because they had to be coordinated with the muscles of the face and head. So sucking became part of it. But they also were able to broadcast their physiological state to their conspecifics. And this is the root of relationships. And that is we signal our physiological state in our voice and actually in our facial muscles that whether we're safe to come close to or not, or whether we need help. So there's a difference about being needy of help versus being aggressive. The voice will be different. A high pitched mm-hmm. squeal is I need help. A lower frequency roar is get the hell away from me. Right. So the point is our bodies, even in modern humans who are social mammals, our bodies react to the intonation of people's voices. And so you, as a host, you know a lot about your guests by how they respond to you, the intonation yeah. of their voices. And so the question to me, to you from me is, when will you start looking at your watch and be, in a sense, want to get this thing over with? And the answer is hopefully not because right. of the intonation, the engagement, the accessibility that your body will feel in a dialogue with me.
Yeah, that makes sense that you're picking up on all these other cues. Did you find or do you find that the majority of people don't even have a clue that they're picking up on all these cues?
Oh, well, they don't have a clue, but they do have very interesting narratives that they try to explain why they reacted. So this is where I came up with another word, not just polyvagal. I had to make up new words.
Yeah, a lot of new words.
Because the system, the model required a new perspective. And so I wanted to say, oh, we perceive things differently. But perception implies an awareness, a cognition. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I didn't perceive it, I'm blaming myself for not perceiving it. So we have to be careful. So I came up with a word called neuroception, which really is the nervous system detects no intentionality, just a characteristic of what our nervous system does. It's like if you got stuck with a pin, you'd feel it, you'd jump back. It's pain, but it's a neuroception. It's not a cognition. Mm. So if someone can make a loud noise, you jump back, give a physiological reaction. You're aware of your physiological reaction, but you have no clue what the stimulus really is. And right. what happens is that feeling of the body is called another interesting word called interoception, meaning from inside the body, I perceive things. We're very good at that. The problem is that we're not very good in linking the source of the trigger to our interpretation of it. So you will always get into arguments across the table with close friends, spouses, or relationships who will see in your face something that doesn't fit with the way they want you to look. They want you to look more accessible, more accepting. Right. And they'll see the signals as if you are aggressive or disinterested in them. So that's neuroception. And so what they'll do is create a narrative, say, oh, I guess I'm not important enough in your life. Mm-hmm. Or it has nothing to do with you at that moment, other than you weren't sending them sufficient signals to show that you were present with them.
How much information is actually being brought in versus, let's say, because you were talking about perception, so versus what I'm bringing in from my visual experience and the information?
Well, I wouldn't give you the quantitative point, but evaluation, but what I would say is I would rephrase your question and ask, how much information from my intentional aware brain is coming in versus what's coming in on this more neuroceptive or reactive or reflexive level? And I would say the one that your nervous system takes most seriously is not the cognitive intentional thought. It's the bodily reaction. Mm. So people can, in a sense, become dysregulated. They can become reactive, irritable, angry from literally a physiological reaction to a facial expression. Wow. And not, okay, so we think we convey all our information that creates relationships to the words we use. Now, since you're on this quest of understanding relationships, you know that language can be useful, but it's not the common denominator of creating that relationship. There's something else in which the other person's body or both bodies feel there's a degree of symmetry and, well, I use the term co-regulation, and literally a felt sense of safety in the interaction. So it means they're sending signals of safety to each other.
We have a new, well, he's now 1 year old, our son. And so a lot of the conversation you're talking about with co-regulation and the suckling and like learning all about how to soothe him when he was a newborn, especially, I see how important it is to be regulated in engagement with him. Mm-hmm. But I also look at, you know, my experience of being younger and being in relationship and getting defensive, let's say, for example, I'm seeing like how I wished I would have known this level of relating that was able to make sense and contextualize why I was reactive, you know?
Well, there's two parts to your wish. One is, yes, it's always helpful to have an understanding of what's going on, but mm-hmm. it's also very helpful to understand that we are human and that we will react to these cues, even though we know what they are and where they're coming from. So it's like when your infant starts crying and becomes, you can't calm them, you're going to go into a state of frustration that may often, in young parents, trigger almost a sense of anger because they can't control the situation and they can't use language to control it. So the body feels that the uncertainty of the behavior near it is literally a threat to the predictability and regularity of what we want our lives to be. So yes, understanding is helpful, but it's not everything. So what people tend to get mixed up in my role, they want me to give them basically suggestions of how to live their lives. Yeah. And I can give some basic principles, but you know, I'm as vulnerable as they are. You know, right. I'm a human being as well. And I see it happening to me. It doesn't always make me happy that I have reacted. And then I become aware and I have certain rules that I try to deal with, not easy in our world, and that is get my body out of the situation so that I can calm down and get that physiological reactivity dissipated so that the intentional, aware, and I would say accessible person can be there.
What did you find were some of the most maybe compelling or shocking things that you learned as you went down this journey of wanting to understand it more deeply?
Well, I would say being a father was the most challenging one because, remember, we're all bombarded with the belief that behaviors are intentional. And so when our children don't behave the way we want them to do, mm-hmm. what we tend to think is we need to punish or reward them. And that's all we need to do. And then everything will be right because they're smart. They'll figure it out. And the answer is so much of our behavior is not intentional. So much of our behavior is really being driven by the physiological state we're in. And if we were more aware of that and said, well, if I can keep the body calmer or develop skill sets of calming, I can expand and optimize human experiences. So for me, it was, I call it a moral veneer. It's being very judgmental of intentionality based upon the behavior. And what I learned was basically give that up and just say, can I calm the individual? So let's give a real example. You, as your child gets older, he'll be going to school. He will forget to eat or not eat. He'll be kind of like highly mobilized or, let's say, disorganized when he comes home. And what we used to do is basically interrogate the kid when he came in the house. And then we would, you know, tell him to calm down. Once I started to understand my own model, the first thing we did was feed him. You know, he just, now the issue is feeding is interesting because if we go back to that ventral journey, that migration of those neurons of the vagus, that calming vagus, when they go towards the area that regulates the muscles of the face, what else do the muscles of the face do? It ingests, it's nursing, it's food, and we still use food as a portal to sociality because it is, in a sense, a toolkit or crutch of getting that social system on. We give people food. We don't say, hey, guys, fill your gut and let's sit around and digest together. We do. The social event is not digestion. It's ingestion. And so we get the kid home. We give him food. He's ingesting. He's using the nerves that are going to regulate this calming vagal system, which is going to support the other vagal system involved in digestion. And suddenly he's a pussycat because he's now calmer and social, friendlier. And we start seeing different behaviors emerging. And it was a lesson to learn because, again, I was, in a sense, my initial training was in psychology. And psychology is very vested in learning models. Mm-hmm. And basically, over the decades, I realized that learning's good. I'm not saying learning is bad. I'm not saying we don't learn. I'm saying if we had incorporated an understanding that learning is optimized when we're not in a state of threat, hey, our lives would be better. Our kids would do better in school. Our problems in the world would be solved because not only do people think better when they're safe and calm, they cooperate, they collaborate. So they can then solve big problems as opposed to we do well as an organism when we're under threat to deal with proximal problems, our survival. But you know, we don't have to just deal with our survival when that's taken care of. Look at the world problems that we could really deal with.
Right. Well, it seems like so much of the way that our world works and let's say the news, for example, like I don't know how anyone can have hope even for the future if they're consuming a lot of news or constantly in these conversations that are dysregulating that. Yeah. Well, what do you think?
We have, first of all, you're absolutely right, but we have to also place that in the perspective of the timeline of the pandemic as well. So we have, and this is really what I consider a real tragedy of our modern times. Many people not only died, many people went through literally trauma, life threat during the pandemic, and many people had their nervous systems retuned from being more gregarious, accessible, to being very defensive. Because through the history of humanity, when we're under threat, what do humans do when they're under threat? They interact with other people. What happened during the pandemic? Other people became a cue of threat. Screwed up the nervous system. It screwed up how we saw the world. So people withdrew and then became very tentative. And even for people who think they are reasonably social, like I think of myself, post-pandemic, I get overwhelmed when I give talks at meetings with people. Even though I wanted to do that, I wanted to engage, my body says, wait a minute, it's an awful lot to process and deal with. So when we get into this notion of what the news does, we already have primed the body to be in a state of hypervigilance and defense. And then we start talking about politics, whether it's local or national. It's really a melting pot of internal dysregulation, which means what you're really saying is, actually, I will say this, that when we use the word stress and anxiety or fear or lack of optimism, it rests on a physiological state that is not supporting what is called homeostasis, health, growth, and restoration. So when we are in those feelings, we really are living on top of a physiology that is not helping us. Our physiology is defending for us, not healing us. But when our physiology calms down, it creates this platform for compassion, benevolence, generosity, all the wonderful things. So, but it really means that if we are in chronic states of fear, we're not a nice species.
Right.
We're just not nice. But it's not nice for a reason. It's not nice because our bodies, our nervous systems feel that it can't afford to be concerned about anything other than the self, me. I have to protect myself.
In my experience, I'm so happy you brought up the pandemic, because that was such a collective trauma, especially like it felt like it never ended. You know, it was like, oh, one wave and then here's another. And I do have a lot of issue with how psychology was triggered in order to try to manipulate human behavior. Like, I think there is an ethical line. And in my opinion, I think some of those lines were crossed in terms of nudge tactics in order to engage in people to, I do think it's important to have nudge tactics. They're an important part of behavioral change. But when they start to moralize things, because I look at now even the conversation about politics as a Canadian too, we have our own challenges. And I'm like, man, like if you're in serious threat, you can't listen. You can't listen. And we seem to.
You're just not smart. That's what I say. Are you scared or are you smart? You know, they're not together.
Well, and I feel like that we're not listening to each other really anymore. And is that a sign of that we're in this form of dysregulation, that we don't have the ability to be with difference, to be with discourse, to be with, an ideological threat is very different than a physiological threat, but in the body,
it's not different. The body is interpreting them in the same way. That's what makes mental and physical traumas the same to the body. And that's why they get often comorbidities. The body, the body's ability to maintain health is really sabotaged when the mental state feels like it's under life threat. So these things do occur. The issue is we create cultures that support threat. And I'm going to kind of unpack that a little bit.
Yeah.
Everything that has, forget about this overlay of war and politics and the pandemic. Just look at the structures of Western society and ask the question, what percentage of time are people feeling evaluated?
A lot.
Okay. Then let's look at where that evaluation occurs within the structures. Religion, education, medicine.
Right.
All evaluate. Now, I talk as a professor, and I lived in this sewer of evaluation, if you want to really describe it. Now, And it is despicable in many ways, because creativity requires a degree of safety. So it's paradoxical that you create threat on the people that you want to be creative. And it's really an interesting issue. And the academic world got out of it because it changed the metric. It says it's really not the creativity. It's not the, in a sense, long-term product. It's the short-term cash flow that you bring in on your grants or your publications or your visibility or your clicks, whatever it is. It was a monetized model without a long-term view. So it took the same notion of productivity by increasing the movement and not increasing the quality of the product, or let's say the expansiveness of the challenge.
That's really interesting, because in my own relationship as someone who creates on social media, that I found myself hitting the ends of my capacity and actually realizing recently I've announced that I'm going to be deleting my Instagram account. And my Instagram and my Facebook, I have over 1.2 million people that I reach on it. But I have to tell you, from a nervous system perspective, a friend of mine was saying to me, well, why don't you just create a healthy relationship with the platform? And I said, I actually, after 3 years of evaluating in the speculation about it, I've been on there for 9 years, 10 years. I was like, I actually don't know that the platforms are designed to have a healthy relationship with. There's no, and these specific platforms are interesting because they're unique in that they don't compensate the people for the content they create that does well. So there's not an exchange like a reciprocity that a human would experience. Instead, if your business is built there, now you're reliant on it. And if anything changes on it, I'm in fear all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, did I get the right algorithm? And I personally don't want to operate in that way because it feels like I have to constantly be in fight, flight, freeze, fawn. Like
you're really rephrasing it as that you're constantly evaluating the platform, your relationship. Yeah. So you're describing it. And I find social media in many ways despicable because it's not the same as being vetted by academics in a peer reviewed journal. It's something else. It's where people have, it's democratizing, but not necessarily in the beneficial way of democracy. It's like saying, it doesn't matter what you say, it's all the equivalent.
Right.
And being an academic, that is not the values that I at least grew up with. And then I start seeing comments, let's say comments on polyvagal theory that have nothing to do with the theory, just misunderstandings and literally people not being nice and being inaccurate. And you start saying, why are they doing that? Or how do you deal with this? And you can't, you get on those platforms, you basically go into their level and you start getting into the mud. So I just never went into that. I just stayed within quote peer reviewed journals. You know, it's like saying I'm not in that space.
Well, do you think from a nervous system perspective, we even have the capacity to operate in those spaces in a way that?
No, because so if we use you as an example, and you're really saying, what is it that is affecting you in your attempts to create a relationship? You can articulate it's non-contingent, meaning that you can't do anything to regulate the other side of the relationship.
Yes.
And what that means, if it's non-contingent, it's unpredictable, which is also what you're saying.
Yeah.
And that triggers in your nervous system a sense of fear, which is really someone evaluating you or evaluating the quality of your work or your community without any recourse, without any feedback into a system that would self-correct itself.
That's exactly it. And initially what led to that pathway of making that choice was that I was just feeling into like, why do I have some form of resentment or dysregulation with? And I was like, oh, it's because I feel powerless in relationship to it. And then I was like, well, why do I feel powerless? And I was like, oh, I feel powerless because the way I operate in relationship to it is giving away my experience of discernment and choice and power. And so I was like, well, I played with the, can I have someone else manage it? But here I would thought to myself, ethically, can I hire someone else to date an abuser? Like, you know what I mean? And granted, I understand that everyone's going to have a different experience with it and maybe different capacity for it. But I don't know that there's, I think we're going to look back and see social media, especially for young teenagers, as being like smoking.
Oh, yeah, there's a type of addictive behavior, but there's also this glorification of being an influencer, even using that term. And what does that mean? It means a lot of people click and have you maintain that space. So it's not even in a sense a product, it's monetization of the clicks. Yeah. So it's not quality. It's a strange world.
It really is.
For you, okay, so you're a couple decades younger than I am, but the issue is it's certainly not the world I came into.
It's not mine either. I'm 45.
Yeah. Well, I'm somewhat older than that. and the issue is I'm watching what I say through the rearview mirror. And the beauty of being, let's say, still cognitively functioning after many decades is that you can literally see how these things are progressing.
Yes.
And part of me is in basically sitting back, not with anger, but with kind of a exploratory curiosity of how does a system, and I'm very in my mind, think in terms of a true system which has its own feedback and own adjustment. How is this world, or let's say the world of social media, is it going to adjust? Is it going to be vetted, or is it just going to shut down and create some other type of portal?
You may have heard my podcast episode with Dane Johnson, where he talks about supporting our detox pathways through things like hydration, sweating, and infrared sauna therapy. He shares how these methods help maintain a river rather than a pond in the body to ensure toxins are cleared. Since getting my infrared sauna blanket from Bond Charge, I've fallen in love with infrared sauna therapy. It helps me put into practice what Dane shares by regularly detoxing my body through sweating, helping to flush out heavy metals and other toxins. I love that I could take care of my body in this way while relaxing, catching up with the most recent thing I'm reading or writing, or finishing a work project. The other thing I love about this blanket is that you could slowly build up time and temperature exposure to explore what works best for your body. And it's not only easy to set up, it's also easy to clean. You just wipe it down with a damp cloth and you're done. My body feels deeply reset and rejuvenated after each session in the blanket. Want to have a daily practice of relaxing and flushing toxins from your system? Try Bond Charge's infrared sauna blanket. They offer free shipping worldwide and a 12-month guarantee. So go to bondcharge.com/markgroves and use the coupon code markgroves to save 15%. That's bondcharge.com/markgroves and use the coupon code markgroves to save 15%. Would you say, I'm curious your thoughts, for the people who control, let's say, the algorithm, and they're on the other side of this relationship, and they're monetizing my dysregulation, right? They're creating this power structure so that I do the things they need me to do so that they monetize more attention, essentially. Yeah. Do they not experience dysregulation from that? Like, would they, I mean, it's almost like a sociopathic behavior if you're not noticing the empathic.
We don't have to give it a clinical diagnosis. Yeah, all we need to do is say is what is their motivation?
Yeah.
And you know what their motivation is. It's the monetization, meaning the activity. So disruption, which will make you feel bad, ups the click rate.
Yeah. Right?
So they are, in a sense, there's a degree of elation because the product for them, if they're mentally, let's say, stable, they're not going to get involved with the content. Their product is really the clicks. And so they're going to feel, oh, this is just great.
Yeah.
But if you have, in a sense, the humanistic aspect or like empathy or caring and feelings when people say outrageous things and you say, we live in a world which we used to live in a world that the community itself would regulate outrageous statements if they weren't valid.
Yeah. And not anymore.
No.
I mean,
you can watch, in the U.S. politics, you can watch this.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, it is like, how can you say things that aren't true? Well, you say it because you're getting more clicks, you're getting more donations, and there are people who believe you.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, with media, it bleeds, it leads, feeds into the more attention, which really they monetize dysregulation then.
And
so, like, how do you begin to separate yourself from that type of... Yeah, like what is even the path to beginning to regulate oneself so that we, because this thing I get in a fight about on Twitter is not that energy that I then bring into my interpersonal relationships. Yeah. I think about the level of responsibility as a father even that requires. Well,
your physiological state is going to change every time you get into an argument. And the question is, how rapidly can you recover? And who can you use in your proximal world to co-regulate with you so that you recover rapidly, as opposed to, in a sense, stimulate more reactivity? So if you get destabilized from some of this stuff going on, and you now have to be, let's say, parental responsibilities, and the child is somewhat active, and your wife needs a little bit of a break, you may be angry at your wife for taking a break and not very patient with the child. So this is basically very predictable from the physiological state of basically being upset or not being calm. So, but the question you're really asking is, where will this all lead?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a simple question. And the answer is, at what point in time will there be, in a sense, no gain, where people will just turn it all off? And so in a sense, the stimulate is all basically lead and bleed. Or actually, my son is a journalist, and he understands this whole bit. And so what you're dealing with is basically an understanding of, in a sense, we could call it, psychology or pop psychology, is that you create conflict and people are interested. You say things in the press that aren't true, but people will keep reading on to find out why someone would make those statements. You don't necessarily create balanced arguments, or you give the real truth and then some outlier who says something outrageous as if they are in a symmetrical balance, as opposed to something having decades of research and someone just making it up. It's not the same. But in the social media, they are the same. And they're not being said, oh, one has decades of experience and 50,000 people, whatever we want to call it. And another one is just someone pulling it out of their rear. There's no distinction.
There isn't. There isn't.
So the question is, in my mind, will this go, or will people keep creating new portals of social media? I guess the next question will be is, Will there be literally a artificial intelligence, alternative reality, social media that will have all the bad attributes, but you will physically feel embodied in doing it?
That's like a next level of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because we already do feel it on a large level, but you're saying it would even deepen more through a virtual augmented reality.
Yeah, but that might be the end of the road, you see. It might be create such feelings of despair or anger and threat and incompetence and marginalization that it might end it.
Wow. Like the technology or humanity or both?
The humanity will just say, this is aversive to me. It's like, would you stick your finger on a hot plate, a hot stove?
Maybe once
by mistake, but not again.
I just wonder if there's so much profit behind something like that, if that actually would, if there is like an off button for humans. Like, do we have an off button?
Well, we do. I mean, this is what we learn about people who have been chronically abused. They dissociate. They put it away. And what they try to do is survive under these adverse conditions. And they do that by, different forms of addictive behavior. So a lot of people with, in a sense, abusive histories are, in a sense, very, very productive. But what does that mean? It means they work all the time. Because if they don't work, they start visiting their feelings.
Mm.
And they basically have adapted to say, to survive, I can't feel. And in a way, these options with social media are very mobilizing. They keep people very active.
Yes. Yeah, you think about how much time people put in on their phones. I mean, they could be they're like second jobs. And maybe for some people, they are their jobs. So I'm not criticizing that. But I think about having an experience of knowing the world before social media and then today. And now I find myself moving back towards that, but also in a beautiful way, longing for it,
Well, just think when children used to go outside and play with each other.
Yeah.
Or in a sense, the word play has been co-opted to mean something else as opposed to social interaction. And even the schools kind of reduce recess time and play time and time for interaction, which are really neural exercises that help us regulate. So the whole thing was in place. Let's go back maybe 50, 80 years. And that is, you play, you knock on someone's door and say, can you come out and play? You don't, in a sense, text them and go into a virtual world. And you move back and forth so your body gets all this exercise. You get tired and then you go home, you eat, and maybe you might even read after eating because there might not be a television.
Right.
So things were different. And the amount of information, I'm not saying the amount of accurate information, but the amount of information that we're bombarded with is just immense. And so the choice of what we look at, even in terms of television stations, so you don't have to go back too far, go back to your parents' age. And they basically, there were three networks.
Yeah, we had three channels when I was a kid. Yeah.
If you were lucky, meaning that you were near a metropolitan area that had three, because it was through the air antennas. So, the things have changed. And now you have hundreds of channels of streaming, and you can watch anything. But there's no, in a sense, standard, like the major networks had standard news. And they were not long shows. They were basically hitting on major events.
I've often thought about how consciousness as an experience has caused us, in some way, there's an arrogance to it that we don't believe we're mammals still. You know, so there's a disconnection from that. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to kind of push that even further.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about consciousness, we're really elevating the cortex to this supreme spiritual level. Mm-hmm. And we're, in a sense, dismissing the importance of these lower brainstem foundational circuits. So rather than seeing that we are animals, we have a brainstem that is similar to all other mammals, and not that dissimilar from reptiles, but slightly dissimilar, that we need to understand that we have common behavioral patterns to survive.
Yeah.
And that we put on top of this amazing, interesting cortex that can create dreams, create stories, can do all kinds of wonderful things. But it can only do the wonderful things if the brainstem
right.
is convinced on a very simple level, I'm safe. That's all. I'm safe. Yeah. And what happened, and this is in a sense, everyone is thinking about consciousness and the evolution of consciousness, and they're thinking about the self-induced states of consciousness. Psychedelics is now coming into play again after, let's say, 50 years of, or actually it's more like 60 years of, being viewed as something that wasn't good. But even that requires the body to be in a state of safety. But even with the use of psychedelics, we're seeing it as a drug model, a fixing model, without realizing a safe body will probably have a totally different psychedelic experience than someone who's frightened.
That's interesting. Do you think that psychedelics then because I think of different technologies like psychedelics, breath work, cold plunging, all these kinds of things. I'm sure you get asked a lot about cold plunging because it's all the rage. But yeah, like, do you see these as one, effective ways to begin to learn regulation? And two, is there something about the, let's say, breath work, the intensity of it, or cold plunging, cold water exposure, that allows the nervous system, because it would seem like it would get activated, but then does it go into a state of rest after that?
Well, cold plunging triggers the more ancient vagal circuit that can literally shut you down. So you need to be literally trained and prepared for this. It's kind of like some of the pranayama yoga techniques of where they would roll their tongue back and, get certain types of reactions that could actually cause people to be nauseous or fainting if you didn't train to do this. So the part of it is, you can get certain experiences, but what's going with that? Is there a psychoeducational component of understanding the physiology and, in a sense, inviting the exploration of the range of your body? Or are you doing it for a fix? It's likewise with breath work. Breath is really a powerful portal into regulating many of our visceral organs because most of our autonomic nervous system is totally out of contact with intentionality. Mm. Although intentionality can impact on it. So if I have lots of, let's say, mental effort, can downregulate the homeostatic, the health parts of our autonomic nervous system. So when we are working hard intellectually, it can be a lot of fun, but it's hard on our body. And that's why we need to get up and walk around and do some breathing. So it's not like I'm sitting and working and that's the equivalent of sitting and resting. It's different. Autonomically, it's a very different state. But the bit with breath work is this portal that can actually affect your heart, it affects blood pressure. And if you can slow it up through breath work, you can start having some very beneficial physiological effects. Currently, I'm working on a different strategy, and that is we're developing what I call polyvagal music,
oh,
which
awesome.
is which is really music that uses the body's rhythms, the same rhythmicities in our body, these slow rhythms of digestion, the slow rhythms of blood pressure that are often seen in heart rate variability as well. The music is composed with these rhythms in it. So it's in training the body to basically be rocked in. The visualization is floating in the sea on a raft without any fear of falling off. So you're going in these very, movements and in total, all hypervigilance, all fear of you trust the environment and now you're experiencing it. And that I think is really the way that we will get back. So get back into our bodies in a sense, this degree of embodiedness. So it's basically music that is embodied so that we can send signals to our body to say, I worked hard all day. I've been hypervigilant. That kid was crying. Wife was irritable. Can I listen to something that will just take away all the need of my body to be aware of where it is so that I can just And that's what we're working on. Because our society needs a toolkit because it's not creating environments that allow the body to give up its defenses.
So because we have so much accessibility to information and constantly other people, does that not allow us to get into that rested
state? Well, I would throw it back at you. What do you think?
Well, my thought is that my own experience is no. Like there's too much accessibility to too many, I would even say too many connections that lack depth.
Yeah, well, that's part of the world. The world, that you could say it's a shallow world that keeps us active. But if we think of it using a different metaphor and we ask the question, what do people who have trauma histories do? That's what they do. They keep active without any deep relationships. And if you talk to people who have had adversity, it's not that they don't want relationships. They don't want deep relationships. They will tell you their body doesn't allow them to have that. That if they get close, they're going to bolt out that room. Their body says, too vulnerable. So the paradox to those who have trauma histories is accessibility is translated in their nervous system as vulnerability. And that is that they're telling you what it is that's most important in life. Most important in life is to be accessible that enables you to connect. If you have a trauma history, you still have that intention.
You have the
desire. Those lower brainstem areas say, not in this body, and will do whatever it can to, in a sense, navigate and negotiate to get the body out of the opportunity or give the body permission to be safe in the arms of another.
From your perspective, how would one, like let's say someone listening or watching has a trauma history, or someone listening is just like, yeah, my body, I would imagine 99% of bodies experience, you know, often dysregulation in relationship. How do we begin, or what does the journey look like to get to what you're saying, which is like this ability to relate, to be aware, but to, and not to say be perfect, because that's not possible.
So let's contrast it with what most people think they need to do. And that is, they think they need to ignore their body's reactions to function within the world. Yeah. Now, if we take that ignore and like the word numbness is really what happens, many people can't tell you what it feels like to be relaxed. They don't even know what it is. It's just not in their visceral vocabulary. But if we start explaining to them that there is actually a consequence on a neurophysiological level of numbness, it's turning off the feedback loops of your nervous system that keeps you healthy. So that's why many people who have these trauma histories, who have this numbness, have a lot of cardiovascular problems, gut problems. I mean, it's like these comorbidities, which that's how a psychiatric perspective views it. It's like you may have depression and anxiety, but comorbid, you have irritable bowel syndrome or hypertension. The issue is these irritable bowel syndrome is not necessarily caused, but is highly correlated with individuals who have trauma history.
Trauma history, yeah.
So it's really just saying the autonomic nervous system got retuned in a way to keep that body defensive, and it interfered with digestion. And we can see this thing growing early in life, because what are some, you'll find out soon when your kid goes to school, but what happens to the, in the families where the child says, I don't want to go to school. And what the child is frequently saying about that is that my body goes into a state of life threat when I go into school. I feel evaluated, or I feel scared, or feel that I'm going to be injured, like being bullied. And of course, what does the parent say? Don't worry, go to school, you'll get over it.
Right.
That's what, because we live in a world that parents have to work too. They want to get the kids off to school and get, and assume it, with this optimistic perspective, that as the child grows up, the child will figure it out. And that is true in certain cultures and certain worlds. But as we start describing a world that becomes less sensitive to other people's physiology, which means feelings, and treats people as if they are two-dimensional screens and cognitive individuals, the respect for the person's feelings, as like your discussions on being on Twitter or Facebook on a platform, is that there's no sense of reciprocity in people's feelings.
Yeah, there's no humanizing of them. And I noticed that, like, for example, when we get dysregulated or people can't disagree about something, let's say one person is interested in the dialogue and the other is not. What I've noticed is online, that's very easy to do, because you're not sitting down with like your uncle or something, or like someone who's close in your family, where you actually get to hear about their human experience of what's behind, let's say, their beliefs or their perspectives. But I think when I consider all the, when I was a pharmaceutical rep, I actually, the first drug I ever sold was for irritable bowel syndrome. And that drug's since off the market. But I remember when I sold that, one of the gastroenterologists would, he had taught me that some of the studies showed that sexual abuse as children was correlated to IBS. And he, if he was to present that, I remember he would get in trouble.
Yes.
And it wasn't until I was, you know, working in relational spaces, starting to study all this, that I was like, it's so obvious that the dysregulation leads to a lack of peristalsis and gut dysregulation. Yeah. So, yeah.
So the peristalsis is literally the nervous system is giving permission to the enteric system to do digestion, giving it permission.
Yeah.
Meaning that if you're hypervigilant in a state of defense, you can't give that permission.
Right.
So if you have an abusive history, your nervous system's tuned to be defensive and hypervigilant. What's going to happen to digestion? You don't have permission to do it.
So I'm curious, what I want to start with, what is possible if we don't change? Like, what can happen if we're not really being mindful about our nervous system being regulated, putting in practices, you know, that kind of
thing? Okay. So first of all, you come at it with your experiences, which not everyone has.
Yeah.
So you came in as a pharmaceutical rep or a salesperson within that. So you were, in a sense, bought in, at least at some point in time.
I was. I was definitely bought in. I drank the Kool-Aid, a couple extra glasses.
Yeah. That, well, it's a belief system that pharmaceuticals can fix.
Yeah.
They can fix. But that's part of the myth of medicine, that all you need to do is assessment, and that's where most of the cost of medicine is. You assess, you look at blood tests, you look at all these variety of things, and then you can do personalized treatments. And that's where, in a sense, they wanted to go with genetics. So you have pharmaceuticals and genetics, and now you have personalized medicine based on genetics. It's a myth. It doesn't mean there isn't going to be important information coming from that. But like in the area of gastroenterology, what percentage of the referrals have no pathophysiology?
Right.
It's more than 50%.
It's a lot.
And that's because it's not pathophysiology in the damage of the end organ, which is what they're calling pathophysiology. Mm-hmm. It's dysfunction of the neural regulation of the organs, like the gut.
Right.
It's a dysfunction of the neural regulation, but medicine does not have a good toolkit or a toolkit at all to measure the dynamic regulation of the gut.
Wow. Yeah. And so,
because it's not the question. The question was pathophysiology, pharmaceutical.
Right. Like, where's the thing we can give you to solve your problem instead of going down that, seeing that as a symptom?
Yeah.
Not to say there's not a place, of course, for some resolution of acute issues or chronic issues. But at the end of the day, if you don't get to the center of the problem, which is, let's say, in those cases, the nervous system.
Yeah.
You're just putting a Band-Aid on, aren't you?
Okay. But here's the problem. The problem is that most medical schools are not very nervous system oriented. They want molecular. They want genetics. And yeah. So they drank the Kool-Aid as well. And the federal government, I had been funded for actually decades for the NIH for my research. And, you know, I'm no longer active on that level, but I was well funded. But they were losing interest over time on neural regulation. It became low priorities.
Do you think it's because it seems too easy? Like it's
no,
not that neuroregulation is too easy, but that like if you were to teach regulation and study much more deeply how to give people that opportunity, that you would actually resolve a lot of these things.
Well, you have to see it from what people have learned, and they have in medicine. It was really a history of what's called nosology, and that is system clusters define disease. And then the assumption is disease has an underlying pathophysiology, but it was all based on symptom clusters. So we can just play with the GI tract and the symptom clusters come up, but where's the pathophysiology? And the issue is there's a disconnect. That disconnect has resulted in severe maltreatment of many individuals, because you know what happens when the pathophysiology doesn't check with the symptoms. How are the patients treated? They're treated as if they're faking it. They're being told by their internist to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist has very little interest and also very little knowledge of neuroregulation of the organs that are producing the symptoms. So it's the orientation. So the point I wanted to get back to right at your question is that a lot of this starts off with advocacy groups that are disease-focused, and the funding units of the government that gets the research done. So the funding units are not interested in what I would call foundational core variables or core features that transcend many disorders, both mental and physical health. They want specificity with diagnostic features. That's what they want. So my work is all about core features that cross many domains, mental, physical health, and even injury. And the point was that the funding units are really pushed by, let's say, families of autistic kids, the pharmaceuticals dealing with depression and anxiety. There's all these pressures linked to various diagnostic labels. We're still a very diagnostic label oriented one, even though the diagnostic labels are extremely diffuse and tell us very little about underlying even pathophysiology. But it's the worldview. So pharmaceuticals said, okay, there's something wrong with the gut. We'll look at the receptors. We'll create a targeted drug. We'll give the drug. Everything will be fine. Families will be great. Kids will live good lives. You know, it was a myth. Some of the drugs have been very helpful, but most of the drugs have been helpful in acute situations, because acute use of drugs is very different than chronic use.
Yeah.
Chronic use, the nervous system, which is being fed drugs to affect the receptors, changes over time. So if you keep using drugs, the system tries to adapt and find another way into expressing the pathology.
Well, I think about the number of people that I know who have some form of autoimmune that was triggered, maybe not directly, but over chronic stress from childhood or a trauma. Yeah. And there you have rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe it's people actually with inflammation of the gut lining, like ischemic colitis, you know, that are told you can't cure these things. And then when they start to do nervous system work, you know, and really, you know, I think it's layered, but it always, I think it all comes back to, can you get back into regulation? And what do you think is possible for people from?
I think a lot is possible, but I think it's a big, big challenge. So you really want to know what are the steps. The first step is really the awareness of one's own body. And that's not as easy as we may think it is. We may say, oh, you need to be aware of your body. But people who have had trauma histories don't have a clue what you're talking about because their nervous system has successfully helped them survive by not allowing the feedback to be experienced. So in a sense, we're dealing with something that is so deep and so, I would say, successful that we're saying, give it all up now. And so I have kind of this phrase that I use. We're dealing with nervous systems that are reluctant to relinquish their defenses. They don't want to give it up.
Yeah,
so we're talking to people and say, certainly you want to give this up. And the answer is, do you know what it means if I give this up? Do you know what pain I will feel psychologically or where I'll go in terms of my visualizations? Do you want me to have that visceral feeling of that time when I was raped or a time I was abused or bullied or, you know, humiliated in public? Because those visceral feelings are linked to mental images. And when they come up, they're triggers, profound triggers to people, and they don't want to touch those. And we can understand why.
Yeah.
So the psychological education or psychoeducational becomes profound, that kind of intertwines the nervous system work that you're talking about and the experiential. They have to understand that what they are feeling is a body reacting, and it's not wrong for the body to react. It's not illness. It's natural adaptive reactions. And what we learn, I'll say we collectively as a community, is that there are such a things as neural exercise where you literally touch those feelings, meaning that you get that physiology to be triggered and then it resolves. And then over time, you realize you can trigger it and the resolution is automatic. It just dissipates. So what often happens is that there's this anticipatory fear that if I get triggered, I'm into the great abyss. I'm not getting out of it. And so literally they're being tickled a little bit. They resolve it. They get a little more. And that's what
it's like. That's exposure.
What, yeah. That it's not exposure often is whoosh. This is titration. It's a different concept. It's pendulation is another word that's frequently used in this world. But it's titration allows the system to get used to resolving the challenge.
Are they doing that from someone who's trained in somatics and then they're being walked through visually and verbally?
Yeah, well, it's the sequence that goes through in a treatment program called somatic experiencing that was developed by Peter Levine. And he uses the word pendulation, which is you basically trigger and you allow it to resolve. You trigger, allow it to resolve. And the reason it was called somatic experiencing was you could trigger and then you'd get these visualizations. You know, so it starts understanding that the body in certain states is associated with the whole repertoire of feelings and experiences. And they've been very successful. There's a lot of, in the world of trauma, the somatic, they like to, you know, they talk about bottom up, but it's really a top into bottom, bottom then up. Mm-hmm. So you're literally, you know, so it's really, it comes right down, but it's the awareness of the bottom up that is really what somatic therapies do. And they're very profound in terms of their effectiveness when there is a very skilled therapist. What is a skilled therapist? So the issue is when we deal in the world of trauma, the therapist has to be very informed to read the cues and signals of the patient, of the client, the facial expressivity, the voice, the muscle tension, because you want to trigger mild dysregulation. You don't want to overwhelm the individual.
So they're highly attuned to the other person.
Have to be.
Yeah.
Have to be.
Yeah, and if they're regulated.
Yeah. Well, they're co-regulated. The interesting part, again, this is another polyvagal concept, is co-regulation. We as a species, we're not, we think we're self-regulated, but we are not really. We are co-regulated, and then we use memories of successful co-regulation to self-regulate. So it's like the argument with development used to be that children need not to be spoiled. They need to learn to self-regulate. The reality is, like other social mammals, the co-regulation with the mother and often the father creates the ballast, the resilience for the child to go away from the parent. And then when there's a frightening stimulus, to come right back. And so in a sense, they are titrating the novelty and experience of moving away, but they're enabling the parent to serve as a co-regulator to calm them down.
They
make
learn,
them feel safe.
Yeah, they learn the imprint of regulation from co-regulation. Yeah, because they can't self-regulate. But I guess tap into the memories of regulation is what you're saying. Until they're what, three, is it?
Pardon?
Is it 3 years old is when...
The reason I say I don't know, because people will say earlier.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good call. We'll get that person on the internet.
Reason this is complicated, because there have always been these belief systems that infants don't remember anything.
Yeah.
And then they start finding out that there's a body imprinting, or at least assumed body imprinting, to, let's say, surgeries and traumatic events that occur, let's say surgeries for very young infants, that the body... kind of as Bessel van der Kolk, the body keeps the score.
Yeah,
my friend. So the issue is, some of these things become imprinted, but not necessarily at the level that we think of a conscious awareness of the specific event. You may have a much more diffuse feeling of injury or threat or lack of trust.
What is possible for our relationships if we lean in to exploring what you're suggesting?
I think if we lean in, we learn to realize that we cannot control the whole world. We can't even control our work environments usually, but we can control smaller relationships. And we should start thinking more about safe spaces within smaller units that basically enable our bodies to give up its defensiveness for some period of time during the day. And that will enable us to be healthier. So I want to kind of play with this, because I was online with mental health and providers and first responders in Israel. And this was a very interesting experience for me, because I realized, and this is almost within a week of the Hamas event, and I realized that these therapists who wanted to be helpful, and they were down in the area where all this had happened, they were angry and fearful. So their bodies were like this. And I was talking to them and I realized this. I said, you can't be an effective therapist being in that state.
Right.
And the issue is, because you're broadcasting your anger and your fear, and you don't want your clients to do that, to feel that. So you have a certain responsibility. I said, it's not easy. You have to figure out how to keep yourself co-regulated with your colleagues. This may mean that you can't see too many clients a day. It may be too much for you. You have to be very aware of what's going on. So the rules of what I was telling them is the same thing I'm telling you as a parent or telling you as a coworker. You have to be aware of what's happening to your body, and you have to develop strategies to enable your body to calm down. And how? What are the most powerful ones? Co-regulation with another. When we were kids, we would call it playing with someone, because we're moving, which is actually very good when you're co-regulating, so that your body, the reason movement is very helpful, like dance and play, is that if a threat stimulus comes in and you're moving, you're already on your way. When you sit someone down in a dyadic therapeutic setting and they get triggered, they now have to get up, and they may, rather than get up, they may shut down. But if you're already moving, so for trauma people, dance movement therapy has been really a remarkable strategy. So play is what I'm saying is one of the ways that we can engage the system or be more playful.
I like play. Everyone should get a new assignment of go do some more playing, you know?
Well, we should ask this question about educational models. What happened to recess? What happened to play? And why is there such an emphasis on number of hours of cognitive tasks? And the answer is, we don't understand what it is to be a human and a student. We just don't know that the two are intermixed. So we think we're taking time away, but with the play and the arts or band or chorus, you're doing neural exercises that create resilience, enabling the child's nervous system to have more tools of calming and to spend more efficient time studying and learning.
So being out in nature, being in play with other humans, what are some other strategies? I mean, other than, of course, we'll link out all your work in the show notes, but what are some other strategies that people can have, you know, maybe leaving here have one or two?
Okay, so singing. Okay, I'm going to tell you why singing is like breath work. Singing is slow exhalation, but it's also utilizing muscles of the oral motor cavity. So it's stimulating the area of the brainstem that has the calming vagus. So it's working. I often have a kazoo to play a kazoo because humming is another powerful way.
Really?
So there are certain things we can actually do that have a physiological effect. The other one, of course, is you talked about walking in nature. And I start to think about, as soon as you said it, why is that nice? We start thinking, well, it has to do with the beautiful things we're seeing. It's more than that. It's because what we're seeing is often alive, like the ocean is moving and the trees are moving. So when I'm looking out the window now, I see both. I see trees moving and the ocean, and often I'll see birds and squirrels. And that type of activity, I don't feel alone. So living here during the pandemic, I live right oceanfront. I never felt lonely. I would go on the deck and spend several hours on the deck, and the ocean's in front of me, and the squirrels and the birds are, you know, it's very peaceful and comforting. You're not alone.
Right. So being in the company of other living beings, whether they're mammals or not.
Yeah. Well, the interesting is birds are not, but they're social. They broke off of reptiles after mammals did. But they use a lot of vocalization and proximity. And I would watch a family of cardinals that were here, the father literally feeding the babies. It's really remarkable. So when they leave the nest, the father's literally dropping worms and stuff down their beaks. It's really this amazing feeling of getting up the cycles of time and how similar family structures are in other vertebrates.
Yeah, it almost reminds us to just be reminded of that, how important connection is, how healing connection is, can be, you know, with the right people who are willing to do the work together. This has been incredible. I'm so grateful. Thank you for your time. And for the people listening, where can they find more of you?
Well, first of all, I want to mention the book that I wrote with my son, Seth, which is a readable book. And those of you who may know my work, often my papers are not very readable. But Seth's a journalist, and he actually knows the secret of writing to communicate. The book is called Our Polyvagal World, How Safety and Trauma Change Us. And it's in very accessible language of the theory. It's an easy read. And if you want to get to know more about what we're doing, we have a not-for-profit institute called the Polyvagal Institute. And that has a website and has educational material and bibliographies online. It's the website is polyvagalinstituteoneword.org. And then I also have a website I haven't updated in a while, but it's stephenporch.com, I guess. Yeah.
Perfect. We'll make sure the links are all up and for your book too. And thank you so much for putting what people couldn't put words to because it wasn't verbally really understood. And you've taken that and taken a physiological experience that I think made people confused. Like, I want this one thing, but I'm doing this other.
Yeah.
And it makes it make sense.
I would say that one of the take-home themes is, you know, our brain is a complex organ. That's a simplification. But it's not the cortex that appears to be the most important thing to determine our survival. In fact, our cortex is getting in the way at times. Our brain stem is really the switching circuit of our accessibility and our ability to be compassionate with others. So we tend to kind of glorify the cortex and we think of spirituality and consciousness. And in reality, our body's just longing to feel safe.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And to everyone listening as well, we're grateful that you do your work.
Well, thank you, Mark. And thank you for inviting me. And thank you for the good conversation.